Hello, my friends. Today's wrong question is this one. Is the future already decided? I want us to sit with that for a second, because I keep hearing two very different groups of people who both answer this question in the same way. One group emphatically says yes, and it's going to be a dystopian hellhole. Billionaires plus AI inevitably equals techno-feudalism. The other group, just as energetically, says yes, and it's going to work itself out. This has happened before. New technology inevitably creates more jobs than it destroys. Very different futures, of course, but the exact same assumption, inevitability. In today's episode, I'm going to show you why a belief in any inevitable future, no matter how horrifying or how hopeful, isn't just dangerous, it's historically wrong. I'm Josh Allen Dykstra. I've spent 20 years helping leaders design better futures for their companies, their teams, and themselves. Today, I'm going to show you how you can help design a better future too. This is the Hello Tomorrow podcast. Let's go. Let's be honest. Inevitability? It's kind of comforting. If techno-feudalism is inevitable, I don't have to do anything. If abundance is inevitable, I don't have to do anything. Either way, I'm off the hook. I get to observe history instead of shape it. But that relief, that's a lie we tell ourselves, because inevitability is surrender, disguised as sophistication. It sounds intelligent, detached, realistic. We see it all the time. Tech executives saying AI will obviously replace most jobs. That's just how technology works. Activists saying billionaires will obviously rig the system. That's just how power works. Different predictions, but same abdication of responsibility. Both groups get to feel smart, but historically and anthropologically speaking, neither of these positions make any freaking sense. Human beings, we're not a species that survives by passively accepting dominant power structures. We adapt, we organize, we resist, we redesign. If inevitability governs social systems, we'd still be living under the first empire that figured out how to consolidate power. We're here now precisely because inevitability has never been the final word. And history has made that painfully clear. I want to go through three examples today. For each example, I'm also going to be showing some photography because, as you will see, these photos were often a crucial part of shaping a better future. Now, warning, some are a bit intense. You can see them if you want to in the article on my website and in the YouTube episode. All right, first, let's talk about child labor. At the turn of the 20th century, children were basically industrial inputs. 8-year-olds in coal breaking plants, picking slate from moving chutes. 10-year-olds working 12-hour shifts in textile mills. Small fingers, useful for fixing jammed machines. It wasn't hidden, it was normal. Then, a man named Lewis Hine walked into those factories with a camera. Factory owners despised him. He sometimes had to pretend to be a Bible salesman to get inside. He asked the kids their names, their ages, their hours, and then he photographed them. I'm going to show you a few. Here is a boy with a cigarette, with other boys. They're all working at American Locomotive in New York. The smoking boy said he was 14. Here's some girls in textile mills in North Carolina. The girl on the left said she was 10 years old and had been working there a long time, more than a year. The girl on the right said she was 12. This boy worked in a coal mine called Turkey Knob Mine in West Virginia. In 1912, Hine photographed this boy named Giles Newsom in North Carolina. Giles was working at Sanders Spinning Mill in Bessemer City. A piece of machinery fell on his foot, he stumbled, and his hand went into unprotected gearing, crushed and tore out two of his fingers. He was 11. 7 years later, Giles died of the Spanish flu. He was 18. He was still working in a textile mill. These photos helped detonate something that arguments never could. But even with this brutal truth, reform didn't gracefully glide in. Federal child labor laws were struck down by the Supreme Court twice, in 1918 and again in 1922. Industrialists fought, states resisted. Their reasoning? States' rights, parental rights, free markets. It took the Great Depression, mass adult unemployment, and FDR's New Deal before Congress finally passed child labor protections that stuck. That was 1938, 26 years after Hine photographed Giles Newsome. An entire generation of children worked in those mills while lawyers argued in courtrooms about whether the government had the authority to protect them. Child labor didn't just disappear. It wasn't an inevitable outcome. It was exposed, it was resisted, and then it was forced into exile. Second, let's talk about women's suffrage. I've heard this story told like it was some sort of inevitable civic maturation, but it most certainly was not. This was a multi-generational war of otherworldly persistence. The fight for women's suffrage lasted over 70 years, longer than the average lifespan of that time period. Women marched and organized and petitioned, and they were mocked as hysterical, jailed, beaten, and tortured. Here's the brief story. In the U.S., we could probably put the starting point for women's suffrage in July of 1848. That was when about 300 people gathered in Seneca Falls, New York, for the first Women's Rights Convention. This was organized by Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott, and they produced a Declaration of Sentiments, basically the Declaration of Independence, but, you know, with women included. The most controversial demand, the right to vote. Barely passed. Many of the signers actually later withdrew their names because of the backlash they felt. But the movement never died. 70 years later, in January of 1917, 12 women arrived at the White House gates. Now, I want you to notice everything that happens in this one year, right? We're in January 1917. The women who showed up at the White House, they're carrying banners. They're not saying anything. They just stand there 6 days a week. They became known as the Silent Sentinels. President Woodrow Wilson did his best to ignore them after they declined his offer to have tea. Then in April of 1917, the United States entered World War I. Wilson declared, "We were fighting to make the world safe for democracy." And the suffragists changed their signs to address him as Kaiser Wilson. People didn't like this. Mobs attacked the picketers, tore their banners, beat them up, while the police stood by and watched. Now, in June of 1917, the police finally decided to intervene by arresting the suffragists. Minor and false charges, like obstructing traffic. They were on a 15-foot-wide sidewalk in front of the White House, right? This got the ladies sent to a place called Occoquan Workhouse. In Occoquan, in response to the rough treatment, poor conditions, and 2 weeks with just bread and water, one of their leaders, Alice Paul, started a hunger strike, which led the guards to force feed her through a tube in her nose. Here's a photo from the suffrage battle in the UK, where this same fight using very similar tactics was happening at almost the exact same time. So then, in November of 1917, 31 women picketed the White House. All of them got arrested and arrived at Occoquan 4 days later. The superintendent then ordered his guards to teach them a lesson. And what happened next became known as the Night of Terror. Here's how History.com describes this. Lucy Burns had her hands shackled to the top of a cell, forcing her to stand all night. The guards also threatened her with a straitjacket and a buckle gag. Dorothy Day, the future founder of the Catholic worker movement, was slammed down on the arm of an iron bench twice. Dora Lewis lost consciousness after her head was smashed into an iron bed. Alice Kosu, after seeing Lewis's assault, suffered a heart attack, didn't get medical attention till the following morning. Remind me of their heinous crime? Oh, right, holding signs. When the women were finally released, many were too weak to walk. But news of the Night of Terror spread, and the public was horrified. Now, in January of 1918, a year after they started picketing and 2 months after the Night of Terror, President Wilson announced his support for women's suffrage. In June of 1919, Congress passed the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote. And it was ratified the following summer, 72 years after Seneca Falls. This amendment didn't pass because time passed. Systems don't eventually just yield. They yield when the pressure becomes unbearable, not because the change was inevitable. Third, let's talk about workplace safety. On March 25th, 1911, a fire broke out at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory in New York City. Employees tried to escape, but couldn't. Why? Mostly because the exits were locked. Why were they locked? To prevent theft from the employees and to prevent unscheduled breaks. 146 people died, mostly young women. Some perished from the fire itself, some from smoke inhalation. Some got trampled in the too small and too dark stairwell. Some died when the fire escape collapsed underneath them, and some jumped from the windows to their deaths on the street below. Max Blank and Isaac Harris, the factory owners, actually profited from the fire. Their insurance paid them $60,000, about $400 per worker killed. Well, they were later fined, though, $75. Not per death, total. Now, 2 years later, Blank was caught locking exit doors again in his new factory location. Now, you got to know, this wasn't just one jerk boss. This was the perfectly standard practice at the time. Systems, my friends. But public outrage did help reshape labor law. A few months after the fire, New York created the Factory Investigating Commission and gave it a lot of power. Here's a few things the commission did. They investigated 1,836 factories and ended up passing 60 out of 64 recommended laws. They rewrote New York's entire labor code, fire drills, sprinklers, unlocked exits, building codes, sanitation, and limited hours for women and children. New York went from a kind of industrial hellscape for workers to the most progressive state for labor in 2 years. Now, you're hopefully seeing how this works. Just like child labor and women's suffrage, workplace safety wasn't born out of inevitable progress or enlightenment. It was born out of catastrophe. It was written in smoke and ash. And it wasn't the fire that actually changed things, but the collective public response after that. That's what made change possible. A week after the fire, people marched 100,000 strong down Fifth Avenue in the rain. This wasn't just a protest. It was a funeral for the unidentified dead. What do I mean by that? Well, let me share with you some words from writer and reformer Martha Bensley Barrer in a piece she wrote about that day called What is to be Done? Well, the fire is over, the girls are dead, and as I write, the procession in honor of the unidentified dead is moving by under my windows. For 2 hours, they've been going steadily by, and the end is not yet in sight. There have been no carriages, no imposing marshals on horseback, just thousands and thousands of working men and women carrying the banners of their trades through the long 3-mile tramp in the rain. Never have I seen a military pageant or triumphant ovation so impressive, for it is not because 146 workers were killed in the Triangle Shop. Well, not altogether. It's because every year there are 50,000 working men and women killed in the United States, 136 a day, almost as many as happen to be killed together on the 25th of March. And because slowly, very slowly, it's dawning on the thousands of thousands that such things do not have to be. Such things do not have to be. But they very often are, until enough people stand up and say no more. If you've been listening to this show for a while, you've heard me talk about the pattern of gradually, then suddenly. Change compounds quietly for years, sometimes decades, before it becomes visible. Child labor reform didn't explode overnight, it simmered. Women's suffrage didn't erupt from nowhere, it endured. Workplace safety didn't emerge smoothly, it built pressure until it broke through. These things happen gradually, slowly, often painstakingly. But here's what's fascinating. When the suddenly finally happens, we look back and call it, you guessed it, inevitable. Of course women were going to get the right to vote. Of course child labor was going to end. Of course factories were going to get safer. But during the gradual phase, it didn't feel inevitable. It wasn't inevitable. It was fragile, contested, uncertain, but a better future prevailed because people demanded it. Now let's return to the two futures we started with. Future one, remember, techno-feudalism. AI replaces labor. Wealth concentrates. The owners of machines become the new aristocracy. Have you seen a movie called Elysium? It's kind of like that. It's uncomfortable to say, but under our current rules, that trajectory is plausible. If capital owns AI and robot productivity explodes and ownership remains concentrated and tax structures and labor protections remain untouched, wealth will continue to concentrate. We're already seeing it. The top 1% of Americans now own more wealth than the entire middle class. 1%. But that wasn't inevitable either. That didn't happen by accident. It happened because the rules, tax policy, labor law, antitrust enforcement, changed to allow it to happen. We talked about this in my Economics is a Lie episode from a few weeks ago. We are living in the world that neoliberal policies built. So an extension of the trajectory we're on now could very well lead to a techno-feudalist dystopia. That's where current incentives lead. But that is my point. It's not inevitable. It's currently incentivized. Techno-feudalism would not be an AI outcome. It would be a governance failure. Now let's talk about future number two. Remember this one? It's the abundance future. Relax, the market adapts. This group points to history. New technology always creates new jobs, they say. And honestly, that's not entirely wrong, but they are leaving out all of the fight we saw happen in our three examples. And they're making a huge assumption that some other things will somehow magically happen. Specifically, companies will start to invest in human development. Displaced workers will get retrained for new rules. Governments will fund transition programs. And education systems will rapidly adapt their curriculum. Now, the big problem with this possible future is none of those things are currently incentivized. Under current rules, companies get rewarded for cutting labor costs, not retraining workers. Shareholders get rewarded for automation and efficiency gains, not for workforce transitions. Our government's current tax policies, they reward capital investment, not human investment. Our current education system doesn't rapidly do anything. So, no, the market is not adapting. It's following incentives. And yes, in the past, industrialization has eventually created new jobs. After decades of strikes and regulations and antitrust enforcement and public education expansion and labor law battles, the market has never just calmly self-corrected when it comes to protecting workers or reducing inequality or addressing systemic harms. Society eventually restructures around disruptions, but historically, that's required governance intervention, not market magic. So when someone says, it'll work itself out, what they're really saying is that they trust the structural and institutional redesign will happen again. But this kind of redesign, it doesn't happen automatically. It happens when people insist on it. Both of these inevitable futures also make assumptions about the rules. Future one assumes the current rules will stay what they are. I don't know a lot of people who want that. Future two assumes the current rules will change drastically. History says that won't happen without people who act. The real question isn't which future is inevitable. It's who will care enough to shape the next set of rules. We're not in a maintenance era, my friends. We are in a redesign cycle. Technological foundations are shifting. Economic structures are wobbling. Institutional trust is eroding. These are the times when rules get rewritten. Believing in inevitability during a redesign cycle is like watching wet cement harden and saying, well, I guess that's just how it sets. No, it sets based on how it's shaped. And here's the part that matters the most. This isn't about guilt. It's about inheritance. Yours. Every human right that you now enjoy exists because someone before you refused a belief system of inevitability. They too, I'm certain, were told the system was natural, permanent, fixed, unchangeable. They refused to believe it. If progress were inevitable, it wouldn't require courage or fight or rebellion. So when someone tells you that collapse is inevitable, or techno-feudalism is inevitable, or abundance is inevitable, remember this. The future is not written by technology. It is negotiated by people. And the only thing that becomes inevitable is what we refuse to shape. This week's Optimistic Rebellion is pretty simple. For the next 7 days, and hopefully beyond, I challenge you to replace the word inevitable with the phrase currently incentivized, right? AI inequality isn't inevitable. It's just what's currently incentivized. Wealth concentration isn't inevitable. It's just what's currently incentivized. Collapse isn't inevitable. It's just what's currently incentivized. The question isn't whether the future is already decided. The question is whether you believe you're just watching it or you believe you can help build it. Either way, you'll prove yourself right. But always remember, if something is incentivized, that means those incentives can change if enough of us care to make it happen. This has been the Hello Tomorrow podcast, where we cut through the noise, expose the systems shaping our future, and leave with more clarity about what comes next. If this episode gave you a better question to ask about how the future actually gets created, please share it with someone you care about. And if you're thinking, I wish our organizational leaders were having conversations like this, well, that's exactly the work I do as a keynote speaker. You can find me at joshallan.com, joshallan.com. Thanks for being here. See you next week.